Well, good morning, church. As you might be able to tell from my face, I've had a bit of an accident that I thought would be good to share with all of you as I get set up here. First, I have a picture of me 24 hours ago. This is a picture of me at the Salem Hospital emergency room in the trauma unit for a head injury. I was on an extension ladder up on the second story of my house painting yesterday morning, and I had been up there for about 4 minutes when the feet of the ladder that was leaning against my house slipped out, and the ladder crashed to the ground, and that's about all I remember of that. There's about a 3 or 4 minute span of time that I don't have much memory of. I pretty clearly had a head injury of significance. My son found me. My brother-in-law picked me up. My mom met me at the hospital because my wife was in Beaverton for a soccer tournament for my daughter. And long story short, I had some level of concussion. They don't really have a way of measuring it. And 9 stitches, and miraculously, I didn't break a bone in my body, which I don't know how that's possible. I feel very lucky, blessed. I'm thankful to my son, who had to see his dad, and probably thought I was dead, and had to try and care for me when I didn't know where I was, or what day it was. Thankful for my brother-in-law picking me up, taking me down to the ER, my mom, both the doctor at the hospital, my wife, and my mother all told me, don't come to church today. So my compromise is that I'm going to sit while I speak today, which is not my normal MO. Normally I need to move around a little bit to kind of get into it. And I'm going to sit today as a way of just trying to take it a little bit easier, because I know a head injury can be a difficult thing to recover from, and the less stimulation, the better. So I'm grateful to be here, glad that you all are here. I'm okay, I will improve, stitches can heal, head injury can heal, and I'm just grateful to be alive and here. One thing I wanted to say is a thank you to you, the church. Last Sunday, we met at the Marion County Fair. It was really a great morning. It was very hot that day, but we were under in the shade, and it was, I thought, a really meaningful time of gathering and worship. And as we were gathering, I just noticed there was a lot of people, and we counted there was about 375 people who came to church yesterday, including, as Casey mentioned, some people that just showed up to the fair and decided to join us anyway. And I think I can say this pretty definitively, it was the largest gathering of New Harvest Church in the last 10 years. So that was really, really cool. And the amazing, and why I say this is a thank you to you all, is we can't really advertise that we're meeting at the Marion County Fair, because we let everybody that has tickets from us in for free. And the fair wants to make money, obviously, and so it's part of our agreement with them that we'll do this, but we don't really get to advertise it. So we're reliant upon all of you to invite friends and family to come to the fair and to join you. And there were so many faces that I did not recognize. I would imagine it's true for many of you. You saw so many faces you didn't recognize and aren't normally here on Sunday. And that means that you all invited friends and family and neighbors and community people to come to the fair, and they showed up, and they got to hear about the truth of Jesus and finding a life of purpose through the book of Proverbs. And so thank you to you. You're the ones that make that gathering really a fun celebration, because you do the inviting and make it a really meaningful time. So it was a great morning to be together. One other slight bit of business. I had scheduled a baptism class for today, and I don't want to do it today for obvious reasons. So I'd like to do it in 2 weeks on August 3rd. And if you were interested in it, and that's a problem, that date's a problem, then I will meet with you like some other time, a separate time, and we will figure out a time to get coffee or whatever and go through some of that class material. But I'd like to do it in 2 weeks. So August 3rd, baptism class. And if you're interested in that, just come talk to me or email me or contact me in some way, even as you're leaving today, and let me know so I can prepare for you being there. We're in a series on the book of Proverbs, a book about wisdom. And one of the things that I think about wisdom is that life today is hardwired for foolishness. And I think you could think about this in a few different ways. There is the pressure to make decisions very quickly, to the constant pull of distraction from our phones and devices and notifications. And then we're surrounded by influences that tell us that we can have easy, short-term rewards that overlook the lasting consequences of those short-term wins. And so I'm thinking about that, like, financially with credit cards. I'm thinking about that with, like, a FOMO sort of mentality that would procrastinate work or other responsibilities so that they can embrace the thing that's right in front of them. Or it's just speaking and acting without having the full information or knowledge and factual information about something. And so these are the types of foolishness that I think our society just, like, willingly embraces as a way of life. And Proverbs 6, our chapter today, is really going to speak to the demise or the problem with these kinds of foolishness. One of the ways that I think we specifically see foolishness in our society is the speed at which we live. The speed at which we live in our society is so fast. And one of the ways we see this is with the way that we take pictures. Now, almost all of you are here, and you have a smartphone, and you could take a picture in approximately 3 or 4 seconds, like instantaneously, and basically you could take as many pictures as you want. Well, 20 years ago were digital cameras, which were essentially the same thing, just a little bit bigger and bulkier, and before those, you had Polaroid film that you took pictures on. So when you took a picture, you had to really be sure that that was a picture that you wanted, because you probably weren't going to see it again until you got that film developed, and then you would have like a nice 3x5 or 4x6 picture that you could take home after paying for it. So digital cameras allowed you to start taking pictures as many as you wanted. You could load them onto your computer. You could take the ones you wanted and then delete all the rest and start over again. And so it introduced this idea of, we just take pictures as often as possible without really thinking whether we should take a picture. So as I was thinking about this idea, I saw a picture of 9/11, September 11th, 2001, when the Twin Towers were bombed or planed by terrorists. And when, you might remember, the first plane hit the tower, as the news was coming out about it, it was a little bit like, well, a plane by accident hit the tower. Nobody really knew what was going on. There was all sorts of speculation. It was only after the second plane hit the second tower that we started to piece together, like, oh, America's under attack. This is a terrorist attack. People are going to die. This is very bad. It was only at that point. So there was a little uncertainty. Now put yourself in New York City with a digital camera when you can take a picture of anything you want, and you end up with a picture like this of this family here. That's a couple with a parent, and you have the burning towers behind them. Now they're probably thinking, like, look at this freak occurrence. We should get a picture in front of this to kind of commemorate this random crazy thing that's happening. Meanwhile, they took a picture in front of a tragedy of thousands of people that were either in the process of losing or were about to lose their lives. And that's what I mean by the speed of society leads us toward foolishness. They didn't realize they were doing anything foolish, but we look at this 20-something years later and we're like, that's ridiculous. Why would you ever take a picture of that? They willingly entered into a foolish decision because they had a camera that could take a picture as quickly as they wanted. The speed of society leads us on the path of foolishness. I shared a couple weeks ago a quote from a guy who's written several books on the power of the internet to shape society and people within it. And I read earlier this week an interview that he gave, kind of looking at, okay, you wrote all those things back in the early 2000s. Now, 20 years later, what's changed? How has the internet had an influence on us as a society? And here's what he said. And part of why I'm sharing this is because I thought it was interesting that he used wisdom-oriented terms in his description. He said, the internet has given us easy access to information of all sorts, but the way it delivers that information in a scattershot, high-speed jumble, actually undercuts our ability to gain understanding and knowledge. Deep thinking requires deep concentration, and the ability to concentrate is exactly what the net or the internet steals from us. We're hardwired toward foolishness in our society, and thankfully, Proverbs recognizes this and wants to point us in another way, to orient us toward wisdom. And so in Proverbs 6 here today, we're going to be taken into what I would call a school for fools. We're going to be highlighting different aspects or different types of foolishness. And we're going to be given three different examples, not as a way of mimicking them, but as a way of learning from them to live differently, to not live toward foolishness, but instead live toward wisdom. So Proverbs 6, we're going to look at verses 1 through 19. If you're following along in the Bible, the book of Proverbs is right after the book of Psalms in the middle of the Bible. We're in chapter 6, the first section of it, which begins like this. My son, if you have put up security for your neighbor, if you have shaken hands in pledge for a stranger, you have been trapped by what you said, ensnared by the words of your mouth. So do this, my son, to free yourself, since you have fallen into your neighbor's hands. Go to the point of exhaustion and give your neighbor no rest. Allow no sleep to your eyes, no slumber to your eyelids. Free yourself like a gazelle from the hand of the hunter, like a bird from the snare of the fowler. Go to the ant, you sluggard. Consider its ways and be wise. It has no commander, no overseer or ruler, yet it stores its provisions in summer and gathers its food at harvest. How long will you lie there, you sluggard? When will you get up from your sleep? A little sleep, a little slumber, a little folding of the hands to rest, and poverty will come on you like a thief, and scarcity like an armed man. A troublemaker and a villain who goes about with a corrupt mouth, who winks maliciously with his eyes, signals with his feet, and motions with his fingers, who plots evil with deceit in his heart, he always stirs up conflict. Therefore, disaster will overtake him in an instant. He will suddenly be destroyed without remedy. There are six things the Lord hates, seven that are detestable to him: haughty eyes, a lying tongue, hands that shed innocent blood, a heart that devises wicked schemes, feet that are quick to rush into evil, a false witness who pours out lies, and a community or a person who stirs up conflict in the community. This is the word of the Lord, the first part of Proverbs 6. Now, if you were at the fair last week, you might remember that we were in Proverbs 4. And if you've been here this summer, you would know we're going through Proverbs 1 through 9, chronologically. Now, if we were in Proverbs 4 last Sunday, and I just read Proverbs 6 today, we're missing something, right, for those of you who are paying attention? Like, what happened to Proverbs 5? Why aren't we getting into that? So Proverbs 5 through 7 is this long three-part in three chapters, really essay. The first part is about marital unfaithfulness. The middle section is what we just read, and the last part is about marital unfaithfulness. Next summer, when we go through Proverbs, we're going to go through Proverbs thematically, and we're going to look at these two sections in Proverbs 5 and 7 on marital unfaithfulness. But today, we're looking at this middle section, so that's part of why are we skipping over a section. It's because we're going to look at that next summer. The other thing that comes to mind for me about this is if I were to start talking about marital unfaithfulness and sexual sin, I think I would get your attention like instantaneously, right? Like that's a way to grab the attention of the audience. And so it's almost like Solomon, who's writing this, knows he's going to get the attention of his reader. And while he has their attention, he wants to throw in something that has nothing to do with marital unfaithfulness and throw it right in the middle of this longer section on Maryland faithfulness. I have really something important that I want to share, so I'm going to put it right here in the middle when I know you're paying attention, because I'm talking about something that piques your curiosity. But I have something else I want to say that's really important too, so I throw it in the middle. I think that's what's happening here, and that's why we're focused on this section of Proverbs 6. I titled this sermon, Lessons in Foolishness, because that's really the focus of the passage. We're going to look at three different types of fools or aspects of foolishness that is a Proverbs way of saying, don't live this way. It leads to destruction. It's not healthy. It's going to cause harm. But there's something that links all three of these that we're going to look at. They're linked together with one common lesson or theme, and that is this principle. The seeds of today become the fruit of tomorrow. So whether it's the seed of careless financial management or the seed of procrastination and laziness or the seed of divisive, conflict-driven, self-serving behavior, none of these seeds that are planted as we live them out in our lives ever just stay in the ground. They take root, they grow up, and they cause fruit to be born from it. And the fruit of these foolish paths or these foolish ways is destructive fruit. And so we're going to be looking at not just the fruit of the fool, but then in contrast, how then does a wise person live? And the three fools that we're going to be looking at are the debtor, the sluggard, and the divider. Those are the three different people that are focused on here in this passage of Proverbs 6. So first, the debtor. And with each person, we're going to come up with like a contrasting phrase, a wisdom phrase of what are we invited to live into in light of the teaching on this type of fool. So the first wisdom-oriented phrase is, the debtor reminds us to be discerning with your partnerships. Be discerning with your partnerships. Discernment, we actually talked about this with our youth on Thursday night, is essentially the ability to understand truth from error, right from wrong. It's to hear the voice of God and know then how to follow his voice, to follow that path. It's discerning, it's ability to understand something. This discernment of partnerships comes up in chapter 6, verses 1 and 2. My son, if you have put up security for your neighbor, if you have shaken hands and pledged for a stranger, you have been trapped by what you said, ensnared by the words of your mouth. So the specific thing that the opening passage of Proverbs 6 has in mind is essentially what we would understand as co-signing on a loan. Co-signing on a loan is a risky idea because what it does is it allows someone else to make a large purchase while leaving you on the hook if they don't pay. In fact, when you co-sign a loan, the Federal Trade Commission requires a lender to hand you a document called the Notice to Consignor that tells you about the risks that you're taking on. And here's part of what it says on the document. This is the quote. You are being asked to guarantee this debt. Think carefully before you do. If the borrower does not pay the debt, you will have to. Be sure you can afford to pay if you have to, and that you want to accept this responsibility. So the warning here in Proverbs is pretty similar to what the Federal Trade Commission says to a co-signer. It's essentially this: don't become a debtor to a stranger or someone you don't trust. Don't take on their debt. But how this is described, I think, is really interesting. It describes it as if you have shaken hands in a pledge, which is language for like a handshake sort of agreement. But you could think of this a little bit more broadly than just co-signing on a loan. In fact, you could more literally translate this verse as not just shaking hands, but whatever your hands strike or whatever your hands touch. The broader picture is that what you touch is what you connect to or partner with. And when I was thinking about this idea of the things that we touch and being understanding about the things that we're touching with our hands as like an idea of the way that we connect our lives to people and to things, I thought back to 2020. Do you guys remember 5 years ago when everything we touched, we were super vigilant about? If you touched a door handle, literally anywhere, at your own house, you immediately went to hand sanitizer, started draping your hands with that stuff. If you shook hands with somebody, you kind of analyzed it afterwards, like, I don't know, you think they were healthy? They're carrying COVID? Am I now, do I have the virus on my hand? We were always self-conscious about it. Now, some of this was like way over the top, right? And some of it was actually really smart personal hygiene. You should be careful about the things that you touch. They can have an impact on your life. That's what Proverbs 6 is saying. Don't just partner with anyone. Don't just touch anything. Be discerning about it. Now, Proverbs 6 is not saying we should not be caring and giving and generous with other people. In some ways, co-signing on a loan is a way of being generous. So the Bible is not being anti-helping people. We're called to give cheerfully, freely to others, to the Lord. Paul says about Jesus and the way that he gave in 2 Corinthians 8, that though he was rich, yet for your sake he became poor, so that you, by his poverty, might become rich. Jesus was willing to give everything. Incredibly generous. And so that kind of grace shapes the way that we view our resources. Everything we have then is a gift. It's something to share, not to hold on to. Proverbs 3 talked about a few weeks ago when we looked at it, not to withhold the good that God has given us that someone else has a need of, that they actually own it, and God's just waiting for us to release it to them. So when it's within our power to help, God is calling us to be generous people. So what is Proverbs 6 warning against if it's not warning against generosity? Well, I think it would be, I would put it like this, not generosity, but entanglement. Entanglement. Binding your life with a fool in a way that then causes you to become foolish as well. You become responsible for someone else's unwise choices when you link up with them, when you allow your life to touch them or partner with them in some way. We're still called to be kind, but not careless. We're called to help, but not to take on and bind ourselves to foolish risks. That's what this whole co-signing and handshaking is all about. And so it first is focused here in Proverbs 6 on the debtor. But then it shifts and it starts talking about ants, literally ants, as a way to talk about the sluggard. So we've talked about the debtor, and now the second part, we're going to focus on the sluggard. And the wisdom principle with the sluggard is that we're called to be diligent with your time. You're called to be diligent with your time. And about the sluggard, right after the description of the ants, verse 9 says, "How long will you lie there, you sluggard? When will you get up from your sleep?" The sluggard appears in Proverbs all throughout the book of Proverbs in various different ways. In chapter 6 here, this type of sluggard struggles to get anything started. How long will you lie there? As if to say, you're never doing anything, you always have excuses why you can't do anything, and yet you're doing nothing. All you have is these compromises over and over again. But there's another way a sluggard is described. A sluggard starts things, but doesn't finish them. Last week in Proverbs 4, we talked about how some of us struggle not with get going, but to keep going, is what we talked about. And that's the idea here of this kind of sluggard will start a lot of things, but won't finish any of them. In Proverbs 26, the sluggard is described as the kind of person who will fill their plate with food, but can't bring their hand to their mouth. They won't finish the job. They'll fill it up, but they won't eat it. And then another way a sluggard is described is as someone who is unwilling to face challenges in life. They come up with crazy excuses for why they can't do the thing. In Proverbs 22, the excuse for the sluggard about the challenge that they're unwilling to embrace, this wild, crazy scenario is, well, there's a lion out in the streets that's causing violence, and I might get killed. And it's like this bizarre scenario of like, what? You said what? Like, that doesn't make any sense. You can't do this thing because of some wild, crazy scenario that might happen but hasn't? That's a sluggard kind of mentality. And in contrast to all of these examples given to us here is Ants. Now, I know those of us here in Salem, if you've lived here long enough, you probably have a mixed relationship with ants. I would imagine almost every one of you has some sort of ant trap somewhere in your house because summertime is brutal. And as I've often heard, Salem was built on an ant hill. So there's ants everywhere, and we're all trying to keep them out of our homes. And so we have to kind of disconnect with our frustration with the ants and like set back and then realize like ants are pretty amazing creatures. These tiny little things can do a lot on their own with almost no hope, and they learn how to work together so well. And the way that Proverbs 6 is describing it is probably has in mind a certain type of ant called a harvester ant, which is common in the Middle East. And harvester ants are known for going out into the field and grabbing individual small pieces of grain, bringing it back to the nest, and storing it to when the harvest is over. They'll store it in the summer so they have more available in the winter. And the point that Proverbs 6 is making, what's so amazing about this, is not just that they're planning for the future, but they do it without a boss. Nobody's there bossing them around. Nobody's there managing them. Nobody's telling them what to do. They just do it. They do the work. They take after the job that is set before them. No one has to stand over them to get the job done. That's the kind of diligence that Proverbs 6 is calling us into, that we shouldn't need constant reminders and pressure and encouragement to do the thing that we know we're responsible for. God is inviting us to embrace those things. And so the ant then shows us an internal motivation that they have, a willingness to accept the work and the hard work that it takes to prepare for the future, even when no one is watching and no one's telling you what to do. Now, clearly, there is a time for work and a time for rest. And so Proverbs 6 is not saying just work all the time, work hard all the time until you accomplish everything there is to accomplish. Rest is for heaven. It's not saying that. The danger isn't rest. It's putting off work over and over again with the excuse of, I just need a little more time to sleep. That's how laziness creeps in and leads to ruin. It's not overnight. It's just little by little by little. I think Psalm 90 highlights this really well in a principle that's given in verse 12 about wisdom of Psalm 90. It says, teach us to number our days that we may gain a heart of wisdom, meaning that a life of wisdom understands the finite reality of life. Teach us to number our days is a way of saying, God, help me to realize how short my life really is. Help me to number these days. And when we get that, we start to live with more wisdom because we realize the weight of every day and every choice and every minute is so valuable that God has given it to us. Romans 14 says that we will all give an account for the way that we utilize the time that God gave us. Jesus tells a story about a rich man who thought he was going to have eternity forever on earth to enjoy his riches, but he died that night with nothing. Nothing. And it's this reminder to us that we don't know how many days we have left, so we shouldn't waste the ones that we have. That they're all that God has given us a gift. The reminder of the ant is don't waste your life. Don't waste your life. God has given you the breath in your lungs, the time set before you. Take advantage of what you have. If there's breath in your lungs, there is more to do. I had a friend, an acquaintance at a former church that I worked at before coming here, named Jim, who got brain cancer, and he was given 6 months to live. And I remember in my conversation with Jim after his diagnosis, and you've maybe heard this from other cancer patients who are given some sort of terminal diagnosis. He said to me, in a way that really surprised me, he said, everyone has a finite number of days. I have the gift of knowing how many. And I thought, wow, the fact that he could look on this terminal diagnosis as a gift, that the reality is all of us have a finite number. It might be a large number, but it's still a finite number, and it's only getting smaller. And each of those days is a gift. So far we've looked at the person trapped in debt by a stranger or someone they don't trust. We've looked at the ant as a way of looking at the undisciplined sluggard. But the passage ends with the ruin a person who divides causes. And it's a lesson, again, in highlighting a different path of foolishness. And the wisdom principle for this last section, I would describe it like this. Be caring with your relationships. It's very relationally focused. And at the end of this section, there's this Hebrew poetic use of six things and seven things. It goes like this. There's six things the Lord hates, seven that are detestable to him: haughty eyes, a lying tongue, hands that shed innocent blood, a heart that devises wicked schemes, feet that are quick to rush into evil, a false witness who pours out lies, and a person who stirs up conflict in the community. This whole section starts a little earlier, a few verses earlier, in verse 12. And it's all focused on unity and division and relationships. And in verse 12, it starts by highlighting the crooked speech of the wicked man. And interestingly to me, the word for wicked here in the original language is personified and given to Satan in 2 Corinthians 6. He's literally called the same thing. And what I think the text is trying to say is that the crooked speech of the wicked man is the same thing as the sneaky serpent in the garden. The same sort of tactic of dividing, of causing confusion, of misstating truth in order to cause conflict and division. Using words to divide rather than to encourage and to build up. And then it comes to culmination in what I just read, the six and the seven things, which is a Hebrew poetic literary device where a list of things is given and the last of them is the most important and clarifies all the earlier ones. Meaning for this list, we have six things that God hates, but it's the seventh thing that helps us understand the previous six that were given. So it's a person who stirs up conflict in the community. That's the seventh thing that helps us understand the previous six that God hates. And notice the six things that God hates are all connected to parts of the body. And it moves all the way from the head down to the toe. It starts with the eyes, and then it moves to the tongue. And it talks about the hands and the heart all the way down to the feet. Now, the purpose of the list is not just to say these are all the things that God dislikes. Clearly, God dislikes pride and lying. God hates those things. But the point is being made here that God hates those things, at least in part, because they cause conflict in the community. That's the ultimate thing that God finds detestable, and the other six are helping clarify different ways or reasons why God finds those things harmful, because these sinful actions lead to disruption in the community. Now, I would imagine, as you think about your own life, many times when we have pride, when we lie, these things are hard to perceive from the outside looking in. Very rare would somebody know if you're lying. Only you know if you're lying. Very rare would somebody know if you're being prideful. Only you know if you're being prideful. So these small, seemingly simple, easily undetectable lies are the things that cause conflict. And I think there's a Bible story or a character in the Bible that helps illustrate how these small, seemingly unnoticed sins that God hates cause dramatic conflict and frustration in a community and in a family. And the story I'm thinking of is the story of Joseph and how easily pride and jealousy and lies destroyed relationships in his family. Joseph is a character written about at the end of the book of Genesis. And he, as a teenager, has a dream. And this dream is from God. It's a God-given dream in which his parents and his brothers are all bowing down before him. And instead of kind of holding this in his heart with humility, he goes to his brothers and he brags about it. He says, just so you know, you're all going to bow down to me. And he already didn't have a very good relationship with his brothers because He was the favored child of his father, so they already kind of disliked him, but that set them over the edge. Now they didn't like him at all, and so they plot to kill him. But instead of killing him, they decide that they're just going to throw him into a pit and then let him be sold off into slavery, and they're going to fake his death before their dad, lie to their dad. And all of this conflict is solved by the fake murder of Joseph by his brothers. Well, if you fast forward many years, Joseph is now in Egypt. He's been raised up to be a very powerful man in the country. And the region's in famine. So all of his brothers come to Egypt looking for food. And they don't recognize that it's their brother. And Joseph takes a silver cup and he puts it in the grain sack of his brother Benjamin. And if you're reading the story and you don't know the outcome, at this point in the story, you're thinking like, well, here we go again. We have lying and deception and pride all playing out, causing conflict and frustration in a family. But no, it's actually Joseph was wanting to cause a little conflict in his brothers so they'd have to come back to him, and then he could offer forgiveness. And we see this break in this cycle of all of this conflict that had been happening in the family through pride and through lying and through shedding of blood to now forgiveness, which creates a unity that no longer is the family in conflict. Instead, they're unified and they share in love and care for one another. I think that's an example of how we can reverse the cycle of all of the division, that our little tiny sins that are often imperceptible, the way that it can create unity by breaking the cycle like Joseph did there. And so the question that I kind of think about when I read through Proverbs 6 and all of these different examples of fools is, how do we reverse the damage that we've caused? All of us, if we're being honest, have been at least one of those, if not all three of those fools. Unwise partnerships, not embracing the responsibility that God has given us, and causing division through imperceptible sins like pride and lying. We've been at least one of those things, if not all three. How do we reverse the damage that we've caused through the foolishness that we have lived with? Over the last few years, we've had a good number of newer people here at New Harvest. And I think I could generally break the groups of people into two different categories. The first group of people is people that are either brand new to the faith or were very distant from God for many years, even decades. And just more recently have just really felt the Lord's calling of them into a life of faith and of honoring and of seeking Him. And their lives have really been transformed. And it's been amazing to be a part of and to support and encourage that group. But there's another group of people. I don't know if they're equally weighted, but there's another group of people. And this group of people is coming to us almost directly from another church. But they're coming to us wounded, hurting. It could be that the church went another direction in the way that they were teaching the Bible and focusing their time. It could have been that they had a failure of a leader that really let down the congregation and the people. It could have been ongoing conflict that just never seemed to be going away. And so finally, this person or this family felt like it was time to leave because they were done with the fighting. And so they come to New Harvest and they experience healing, a healthy community, and it feels like fresh water when you're dying of thirst. And they just can't get enough of it. And I've been there. About 13 years ago when I came here, I came from an environment that was very toxic underneath the surface, behind the scenes. And I came here, and I remember one of the, like, we can do church like this? Like, this is, like, healthy. Like, I like this. I think I'll stick around. Now, I don't say that to toot our horn or my horn. Like, I inherited this, and now it's part of my responsibility to help steward it forward. But the question that I have is, what is it for that second group of people that have experienced healthy community and hopefully a healthy church moving forward? What is it about New Harvest and the way that we go about living our lives as believers together that makes it so people who come out of unhealth experience healing and restoration here? Why do people who have gone through painful church situations come here and experience healthy community? And I think I could put it very simply in a simple phrase. We seek to be a place and a people that is honest before the Lord. It is that simple. Now, that's not a simple thing, being honest before the Lord. It's a simple statement. It's very difficult to live. We seek to be a place and a people that is honest before the Lord. The last thing that I want to be a pastor of is a church of pretense, of putting on a show, of making it look good on the outside. I want no part of that. What draws people here, what keeps us grounded, is a deep hunger to be real before God and with each other in a way that allows mutual relationship to be built and honesty before the Lord that He chooses to bless and honor. Now, it doesn't mean that we have it all together. It doesn't mean that we're like the best church on the face of the planet. It just means that we're willing to be honest before God and each other about the way things really are. That I'm sometimes foolish and I need God's help. I love the way Martin Luther describes this. He says, we're all one blind beggar telling another where the bread is. And that's, I think, our kind of mentality. Too often, we're willing to play the game of religion, show up to church, serve in these things, do these things, without embracing the relationship. The relationship takes vulnerability. It takes honesty. It means exposing yourself toward others, with others, in a way that's risky. We'll play the game of religion. I'll show up on Sunday, but we don't always want to play the game of relationship, opening up our lives toward one another. And what we seek to be is a place where we're willing to just start opening it up and allowing not only the Lord's healing touch, but a community that will come alongside even as you do. That's what we long for this church to be. It's not a simple thing. It's a simple statement, not a simple thing. Very difficult to live out. Involves sacrifice and risk and vulnerability. I think there's a verse that really ties in this idea of wisdom. How do we pursue a life of wisdom and embrace the Lord's work in our lives? This is something that we take on and we just try really hard to be discerning and be caring and be vigilant. Do we just work really hard on doing that, or is there something else at work that leads us toward a life of wisdom? And I think Paul highlights this well in Titus chapter 2, verses 11 through 14. It's a longer section, but it really gets at this so well. He says, "For the grace of God has appeared that offers salvation to all people. It teaches, the grace of God teaches us to say no to ungodliness and worldly passions, and the grace of God teaches us to live self-controlled, upright, and godly, and we could say wise lives in this present age, while we wait for the blessed hope, the appearing of the glory of our great God and Savior, Jesus Christ, who gave himself for us to redeem us from all the wickedness," and we could say foolishness, "and to purify us, purify for himself a people that are his very own, eager to do what is good." How do you walk into a life that is good? By the grace of God. That's what that verse is saying, that there's no other way to step into a life that is truly good apart from the grace of God. So every Sunday, we come to the table as a way to remind ourselves that I'm not pursuing this life of wisdom, this life of following Jesus on my own. I'm doing it because He provided the way. He gave Himself for us to redeem us from all wickedness and to purify for himself a people that are his own. So we are called to, according to Proverbs 6, to plant seeds of meaningful relationships and to use the time that we've been given and to embrace the responsibility of it and to care for the people that God has placed in our lives. And I truly believe in not too distant of a future, as these seeds are planted and we continue to allow God to water them in our lives, as we're honest before Him, He will produce a meaningful and flourishing life for each of us and allow our community to continue to flourish into the future. That's my hope and my prayer for us as people who embrace a life of wisdom. Would you pray with me as we move toward a time of response? God, I thank you for today. I thank you for your word. I thank you that I'm here today. I mean that very literally. Today's a gift. Some of us don't totally realize that, but it feels very pertinent to me today that today is a gift. And your word has something to say to us, whether we've been the person that's been unwise in the partnerships that we've made in our lives, whether we have skirted the responsibility and the work that you set before us, or whether we haven't truly been caring for the people around us in a way that allows them to experience encouragement and camaraderie in community. We've been more of the divider. God, each of us in some ways, if not always, has become foolish. And we need your grace to lead us into the life that is good, the life that is redeemed through the work of your Son, Jesus. And so as we come to the table, God, we're inviting you, fall afresh on us, begin a new work in us. No one is too far gone from your grace. Lead us into the life of Christ and the life of wisdom so that we can seek to bring blessing to and honor to you. We ask this in Jesus' name. Amen.